Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. My guest today is Amy Bowers Cordalis, an attorney, a Yurok tribal member, and the author of the remarkable new book, The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. Amy's story begins on the ancestral lands of the Yurok people at the mouth of the Klamath River, a place her family has called home since time immemorial. From that place flows a narration about creation, responsibility, and the deep teachings that guide humans how to live in balance with the natural world. In our conversation, Amy shares the intergenerational fight to protect the Klamath, and the trauma and turning point of the 2002 fish kill, and the legal and spiritual battle for dam removal, and that final culminating movement when the dam was taken down. We also discuss how myths adapt, how indigenous knowledge offers a roadmap for environmental repair, and how the story of Klamath and the Yurok people fits in the larger arc of California's history. Let's go meet Amy. Amy, thank you so much for your willingness to do this podcast with me. I'm excited to talk about both your work and your book. Those intersect, but there are different things, and I'm excited to talk about each of those with you. Before we get started, I just want to give you a moment to share a little bit about where the ancestral lands of the Yurok people are in California and the current size and state of the tribe.
Yeah. First off, let me start with Ayakwi, Neknaw, Amy Bowers, Cordalis, Nuwak, Rekwoy, Numite, Wa, Waklau, Waklau, Waklau. I just introduced myself in my Yurok language and said I'm from the village of Rekwoy, which is right at the mouth of the Klamath River in the far northern corner of California, on the mouth of the Klamath. And that I'm happy to be here, and thank you for having me. So I couldn't be more thrilled to be in conversation with you this morning. I am a member of the Yurok tribe, and as I mentioned, my family's from the mouth of the Klamath River, and Yurok's Aboriginal territory was over a million acres in what is now known as the far northern corner of Western California. So the most northern part of our Aboriginal territory is about 50 miles south of the Oregon-California border, right there on the coast. And then it goes down south past the Klamath River through what is now the Redwood National Park to about McKinleyville. And then it goes through that stretch east through the Klamath River up into the first coastal range, which we call our high country. That's the tribe's spiritual lands. And through colonization, our territory was significantly reduced. And we signed a treaty in 1851 that was never ratified by the Senate. Aboriginal territory was reduced in the creation of the reservation in 1855. And so our current reservation is a mile on either side of the Klamath River from the mouth up 45 river miles. And nowadays, we are a modern federally recognized tribe. We are the largest California tribe, and we have about 6,500 members and many more descendants who are not enrolled. And we continue our fishing-based way of life, and we are very connected to the river. We were never relocated, and so basically that has allowed us to attempt and to fight to continue our fishing-based way of life, our culture, our religious practices, our language, all of it. That's who we are.
That's amazing. Let's talk about your book now. So we're going to dig into some different thematic sections in the book in more detail, but I want to start with a big picture, because what's interesting about your book is it weaves a lot of different genres into it. And so I wanted to pick your brain and how you thought about designing the structure and the conception of how to write the book, if you will.
Yeah, thank you. So the book is a memoir about my family's intergenerational fight to protect the Klamath River and our fishing-based way of life. and how that contributed to Klamath Dam removal, which is the world's largest river restoration project in history. And there's a couple things there. I'm a lawyer, and so I've spent a lot of time writing legal briefs about the tribe's legal rights. I've represented the tribe for almost 15 years now. And so I've spent a lot of time in writing legal briefs. I've done some academic writing. And for this story, I really wanted to invite readers to the Klamath River to sit at fish camp with me on the river bar next to a fire with our gill net out in the river and be able to tell readers the whole story. There's been a fair amount of coverage of Klamath Dam removal, and it's just a little tidbit, right? It's all written through somebody else's perspective, which we're grateful to have the story out, but I felt strongly about wanting to tell the whole story through the eyes of my family and myself as we experienced it. And also, I wanted to be able to write it in the way that our elders tell stories, so in a Yurok style. And so it's circular, like it moves through time in non-linear ways. It's spiritual in the sense that there's connections between the salmon, the redwoods, the river, the humans, those both living and also that have passed. And so I wanted to share with readers how I had experienced all these stories. And one, I guess the second thing too is I grew up on the river, right? Fishing and hearing these remarkable, powerful stories of the family fighting for justice. But then also, there were hilarious things that I write about in the book. Things like in Yurok, we don't have in our language any swear words. And when the federal government sent federal marshals out with full riot gear and machine guns to kick us off the river from fishing, just in our home waters, we didn't use four-letter words. Instead, our insults were things like, "Your mama wears combat boots."
Yeah,
So it's just funny things like that I hope readers will find interesting.
let me respond to a few things you said, and then we're going to transition to talking about creation myths. So I think it's really important to tell stories within a cultural language because we all see the world very differently based on our cultural vantage point. So there's a great philosopher that passed away this year named Jonathan Lear, and he wrote a book in 2008 called Radical Hope, and it's about the Crow Nation's civilizational collapse and how it was the end of happenings, which is his way of saying, how do you have meaning if the locus of meaning goes away? And it's a fascinating exploration of how they understand, given that they can't hunt in the same ways, that they can't do the same things that they did, how can they understand the world without the key components of that world going away? It's a fascinating book, but I think it attaches to what you're saying in the sense that I think the story has to be told from a certain place in order for it to make sense. And so let's dig into creation myths now, because I think this is critical. Why are creation myths important? Let's start with a baseline there.
At Yurok, our creation myth is important because it grounds us in who we are and our purpose on this earth and gives us instructions about how we are supposed to interact with the natural world. And through our Aboriginal law, through our religion, through our management of our fishing practices and natural resources, we try to implement those instructions and those core purposes for which we are on Earth. For example, in the creation story, and I started the book with the creation story because, as you're pointing out, for readers to understand my worldview and the Yurok worldview, they have to know the creation story. Right. And so that's where the book starts, is with the creation story. And essentially, what it is that there were spirits in the universe who were lonely and they wanted a place to be together. And so the creator made the earth and then made the water, made the land, made the creatures and the plants and the animals and said, or and then made the humans last and then told us all of this was made for us and we will never want for anything. And what's cool is that's the language that's been passed down. You will never want for anything so long as you live in a balance with the natural world and you never take more than what you need. You only take as much as your family needs just for your survival. And you steward, you take care of the salmon, you take care of the acorns, you take care of the mussels in the oceans, all the creatures, these first foods, right? And you treat it with respect, where everything has a spirit, and that spirit is to be acknowledged and held in reverence. And so we get the privilege of being the beneficiaries of all that natural abundance in the lower climate basin, but we have a corresponding duty, right? A duty to take care of it. And it's all there in that creation story, right? All this was created for you. You'll never want for anything. So there's that privilege, but you have to take care of it. So there's that duty that says you have to manage this and be very careful with it so that you don't take too much. Yeah. And then there was also another part of that story which says if you do take too much, then things won't come back and you will go into this place of scarcity where you won't have enough. And so our religion builds on that whole principle. And the idea is that through sort of our life way and through our interaction with the natural environment, we have to maintain balance, right? So balance, I hold my hand in a horizontal line to say we're in balance with the natural world. So the humans and the natural world are in balance. And that's when you create this like abundance and things go well. And in Yurok, through our religion, we have what's called world renewal ceremonies, which I also talk in the book about in the book because they were outlawed for a really long time by the US government. And we brought them back in the late 2000s, actually. And it's like just in time because we were experiencing also at that time this a massive fish kill. And so there's this whole sort of like spiritual element of these ceremonies coming back, us fulfilling what's called a world renewal ceremony, where we're bringing back the natural abundance, natural resource management, the world renewal ceremonies, even the exercise of our modern law. So our Yurok constitution, our Yurok tribal ordinances, it's all rooted in those original instructions in the creation story. So it's pretty cool in part because we've been in like along the river, the lower Klamath River. My family's been in Rekwoy since time immemorial, like since the beginning of time. And so we have this, I mean, who just a very long tenure in this place with specific instructions about how the humans are supposed to interact with the natural world. And then also, as the Yurok tribe, we have inherent sovereignty, which means we have the ability to make laws and be governed by them according to those original instructions. So if you look at it as like a big picture kind of thing, and you look at different groups of people and humanity, like I feel really lucky to be a part of a culture with such ancient ties to this specific place and with the ability to try to stay true to that. So I had to write about all that in the book, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you a follow-up question because this is something I was discussing this recently with someone. There's a great author who writes about indigenous history in California, and we were talking about how myth can change, right? So like we tell stories about ourselves, and we were talking about this in context of climate change because the world is changing, right? Like things are landscape. If we just look at the Yokuts people who lived in the Central Valley, or before white settlers arrived, we had massive rivers like the Klamath running through the Central Valley. We had a massive
Oh,
lake, the Tulare Lake, that has now since gone. The Central Valley rivaled the Serengeti. It looked like there was antelope running. It was just, it's a different world. And so one of the questions that I posed, and I'm curious what your response to this would be, can you change myth and story if the world around you changes? Like, can you create a new myth and some?
So I think this is a really important question, and it speaks to interpretation of culture and like worldviews. And I think the first thing to start with is to acknowledge the importance of the role of myth in indigenous cultures, right? Because we didn't have written texts. Like you think about the Bible and it was written down, but at its heart, and people may not agree with this, but from an indigenous worldview, it's the stories there are very similar to indigenous myths. And so first we have to acknowledge how important those myths are, because that is how our core teachings, like the origin stories, are passed down through the generations. So they're those myths are core, like fundamental teaching tools for us. So we have to give them that reverence and respect. That's first and foremost. So what I think is important within that, and acknowledging an adaptive, like changing world, and also acknowledging how much colonization disrupted indigenous tenure on lands, and also how much was lost and severed, right, between actual just ecological functions of ecosystems, but also relationships between land and indigenous peoples. And so with that, what I think what it is, and this is just my world view, is maybe you don't change the myth, but you change your interpretation.
Okay.
You change your interpretation, because what our myths offer is a teaching. There's like a fundamental lesson in that teaching. So, take for example, our creation story. What it tells you is that humans should live in balance with the natural world and not harm it. And instead, our role is to steward it. Now, I can apply that teaching to any place. And a part of the book, and why I felt it was so important to get it out into the world right now, and actually the afterword starts with this, is to say the world is greatly out of balance right now. And we see that through the collapse of the ecosystem. And so we can use that teaching, which is in the first chapter of the book, in the origin story of, okay, humans, our role is to live in balance with the natural world, to care and to protect it. And so moving forward, we collectively as humanity could choose to restore traditional ecological functions, to restore ecosystems, to limit our consumption so that we're living sustainably. And that lesson can be applied to any place on the planet, and probably any planet, and anyone could choose to adopt that. And that's one of the things that I really hope people pull from the book, is there's another way of living out there that we could all adopt and really heal the planet. And in many ways, like the whole story of the book and how it ends with Klamath Dam removal, which is so much, and I hope we get to talk about this, like improved the ecosystem and healed the river and the salmon. Like we could all choose to work for that. And think about if we did that, like collectively as humanity, if we said, like, all right, we're going to enter into this great era of repair and healing, we could save the planet.
Yeah. And I live in the locus of industrial agriculture. So I
Yeah, you
definitely,
do.
and so I experience this on a granular level. And I think that What you're describing is what I love about books like M. Cat Anderson's book Tending the Wild,
Ooh, yeah.
which is a fantastic book and look at how indigenous practices of living in and with nature versus on
Yeah.
top of it. And I think there's a lot of those ideas that are old ideas are coming back and are
Yeah.
treated like nouveau or something. And you're like,
Yeah.
no, I think this is how it's, I think you're right. I think interpretation, going back to the how to rethink myth, is more about seeing maybe the specific terms that were used in the myth don't apply to today, but the story applies as a perennial, eternal story. And I think that is a great way of looking at it. I know I have graduate work in religion, and so I've done a lot more work on the big monotheistic religions. But Christians, for instance, are constantly reinterpreting the Bible to
Yes.
make sense of their time. And I think that's true for
Yes.
every religious group. And I think that
Yes.
makes a lot of sense. And I think throwing the baby out with the bathwater is not really what was underlying that question, but I do think how we tell the story needs to adapt to what the circumstances are. Now, we could talk about this forever, but I want to get into some more parts of your book. So on this show, we have covered extensively the history of genocide in California against indigenous people.
Hey.
We had a great guest a long time ago who wrote a book called An American Genocide that chronicles it in excruciating
Yeah.
detail. And so we've covered that, but we've covered it more in the aggregate big picture sense and not in specifics of specific tribes and how they experienced it. So I thought this would be a good time. So could you just maybe briefly, because we have a lot of topics to cover, go over some of the early episodes of violence experienced by the Yurok people?
If I could, can I slightly reframe that conversation? So
Absolutely.
I think one of the most, in for me personally, writing this book and my family's story was so important because we were one of the few families, indigenous families, that survived the genocide and were able to stay on our homelands. So 90% of California's indigenous population was slaughtered by 1910. So that means 10% of us survived, and an even smaller percentage was able to remain on our homelands. And so my family's story is in that very small percentage of people who were able to stay in their home villages and continue the fight. And I start the book with the origin story. And then when we get into the second part of it, I talk about, and it's filtered through the first part, also setting the stage of how we were able to remain in Recuay. We were able to remain at what we call the home place up at Brooks Riffle, which is up the Klamath River. And because of that, we were able to keep our fishing way of life and our connection to the river, our connection to our sacred sites, Oregos, the mouth, the rock at the mouth of the river is one of those, our language, our religious practices, and even things like our regalia. We're a dance family, which means we have roles in putting on those world renewal ceremonies. And so through time, we've accumulated regalia, powerful old regalia, and though that regalia is still used in ceremony, the songs that we've learned, they're still used in ceremony. That like ancient medicine and way of being is still there. And what's extremely, for me personally, powerful is my great grandmother's life and her work. So she was born in 1904 and passed away in 1986. So I knew her, right? Like I, as an Indigenous person in two, what year is it? 2025, knew her. But she was raised by her grandparents. And as a young child, she lived in a redwood plank Yurok house, the House of Layuk, which I talk about in the book. She spoke only Yurok. She lived a completely subsistence-based way of life of fishing and gathering and hunting. And I knew her. You know what I mean? And so think about that in the context of the indigenous experience across the country. Like the tribes out in the east, it was 1492. 500 years ago or more when they lost that like Aboriginal lifestyle in some ways. But here we are in California, and my great grandmother, who I knew, lived it. Like she lived it. And so I wanted to contribute to the history of America by sharing my family's story, which is so unique because we maintained our connection to the land and the river and the fishing-based way of life. And that is extremely rare, but that's the power in that story because now anyone in the world can read that and know this is how it is for these people. And to be able to have the privilege to tell your story and to share that with others is really, it's an important way that we generate awareness and create empathy. And then that leads to equality.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think you're right to push back on my question, which is, and I did in graduate school, I did a lot of research on how Jewish immigrants to Israel told stories of the Holocaust. And there was, because there was a divergence between different perspectives. There was some folks that wanted to really focus on what was lost, but then there became a movement to no, to push back and say, no, we need to tell stories of survival. We need to tell stories of resistance. We need to tell stories of heroics. And as a person that works in history, I think you need both ultimately. But
Agreed.
if we're
Agreed.
looking at indigenous history and how it's been written as a series of tragedies. And I agree with you. But I think in the context of this conversation, why I wanted to bring it up was I wanted to fully conceptualize how the Klamath was taken. And I think the violence precedes the land acquisition and is a tool of that land acquisition. And so I think for maybe let's reframe the question as how was the Klamath taken?
The Klamath was never taken. We're still there. That's the whole point, is we're still there and we
Right.
still have
The
inherent
dam, if you will. The
sovereignty. Yeah, I
dam, the,
mean,
yeah.
what happened was that things were developed. The Yurok Reservation on the lower 45 miles of the Klamath River is a bit of an enclave in the sense that we did stay on that land. We reserved our inherent sovereignty and our Aboriginal rights through the creation of the reservation. But around us, things were taken, right? So, like our Aboriginal lands to the north and the south, and even up into the east. But then, as you go up river, so, past River Mile 45, and basically the rest of the basin, all the way up into where the dam started at River Mile 190, which is the Karuk territory. And then you go past that up into Oregon, which is River Miles, I don't know, 210 through to like 50 or 30. But then if you even go further past into Upper Klamath Lake and then the tributaries, you're talking about River Miles if you keep counting on 300, 400 River Miles. So all of that was brutally taken. And I try to. That this book isn't about that, but you have to acknowledge it. So I briefly mentioned that it was a brutal, awful genocide where basically there's a few important things. One, there were treaties in California negotiated with the Lower Klamath Indians, but those were not ratified by the Senate because the state of California was in the business of genocide. So California opposed those treaties, and that's why they weren't passed. And then on top of that, California passed laws to pay citizens to go out and kill Indians and then stole our babies and sent them to boarding school. And so in my own family, I'm part Karuk too, which is the neighboring upriver tribe from Yurok. And we have awful stories, horrendous stories of gold miners, settlers coming in and raiding the villages. And it would have been like a third or fourth great grandmother was shot by one of them trying to cross the river to flee from these murderous raids. And that's the story of most, California indigenous families. Yeah, if you brought in our scalps, California would give you money. That's the history of it. But I wanted this book especially because we had a victory where Klamath Dam removal happened. I wanted this book to be about that long-term fight and how, even though my ancestors didn't see the victory, all their work and their prayers came to be in 2024 when we removed those dams. And so when you look at it in the context of this 170, 190-year long battle, like eventually the Indians won. And that's what I want people to take away is we've been fighting for all these generations. But we won. Like, we are still here. The river is out. Those dams are out. And, like, we are moving toward the end of the colonial era on the Klamath River because we're reclaiming those places. We're reclaiming the health of the ecosystem. We're exercising our duty as stewards via those instructions we were given. And we're still here, y'all. Like,
Yeah, let's jump into your personal legal journey from being just a member of a community to electrified. What was that inflection point for you where you transitioned to, I'm now going to be a leader and I'm going to lead the charge in using, and I before we get to that, I wanted to ask you, given all the history of the United States making treaties and using law as a tool or ignoring law, why did you feel like law still had opportunity? You know what I mean?
Such a brilliant question, right? You're crazy, lady. What the heck?
Well, I do think I've read quite extensively in the world of resistance movements, and you often have to use the tools of empire to disrupt empire. But I also would look at that, and if I was in your position, I'd feel pretty jaded about the capacity of law to help create change.
My moment was in 2002, experiencing the largest fish kill in American history on the Yurok Reservation on the lower Klamath River when about 70,000 adult salmon died as a result of excessive water diversions caused by or at the order of the then Vice President Dick Cheney, may he rest in peace. But he diverted, he issued an order that diverted a lot of water from the river to support agriculture at the top of the basin over the objections of all the federal scientists involved. And as a result, flows at the lower part of the river on the Yurok Reservation fell the lowest they'd been in history, right when a very large fall Chinook salmon run returned. And the result was a fish disease called ick that spread through the whole run and killed them. And I was a junior in college at the time, and I was home working for tribal fisheries and witnessed the devastation. And it was horrible. It was like a war zone. You can imagine seeing the rotting bodies of 70,000 adult fish. The smell alone was like you were in a war zone. Their bodies were layering the banks of the river three, four layers deep. They were like spinning eerily in eddies and just pooling. And speaking of myth, we have a myth at Yurok that says if the Klamath salmon go away, so too will the Yurok people. So I felt I was witnessing the end of my culture. And at minimum, it was definitely an act of ecocide against us by the hands of the US government. And I write about this in great detail in the book, both the like experience of it, but then also Dick Cheney's role. And there were lawsuits, there were congressional hearings, the fish kill closed the offshore commercial fisheries in both Oregon and California. It was like a $500 million loss, all so that the Cheney Bush administration could try to get votes in Oregon. But what that did, though, was motivate not only me to go into law school, but like hundreds of, I can't even say it that way. It's better said that it launched a whole new generation of indigenous peoples from the Klamath into the fight and our allies. And I had a really powerful moment, and I write about this in the book, where I was witnessing the fish kill, and I'm standing in a Yurok tribal fisheries boat, and I just swear that my great grandma, who had passed away decades earlier, it was like she came through me and said, "You have to fight." And then my next thought was, "I'm going to go to law school to try to prevent this from ever happening again." So the law piece was 100% great grandma speaking to me from the other world and telling me, "This is what you got to go do, girl." And like a good granddaughter, I was like, "Okay."
Let me ask you now, Amy. Let's say you had the task of writing a pamphlet. The title of the pamphlet was How to Remove a Dam, and use your particular experience as a case study in the process. Because I would love to hear the process.
Yes, and this is all in the book, and I felt strongly about this and writing it as like a blueprint, and that's what Yvon Chouinard, Patagonia's founder, says about
Yeah,
it,
and
is it's
I don't want
the
you to give away the book entirely, but
okay.
just give us the broad strokes, and then people can go to the book for the
So
details.
the excellent. So the pamphlet sort of blueprint would be one, raise public awareness about the impacts of the dam on your community. Two, find some kind of regulatory, or whether it's a legal proceeding, a court case, and find every single source of law that supports environmental protection, indigenous rights, community rights, clean water, all of it, and put together legal arguments that combined all of that, form coalitions with multi-stakeholders to keep everybody together, and find really strong politicians, both tribal, states, federal, community leaders, to keep the movement together and everybody on track. And then last, find the money to do it.
Okay, let me ask
That's the
about it.
blueprint.
Let me ask about a few
Oh, wait,
components
one
now.
more thing.
Okay, all
One
right.
more thing. And ceremony, like for us as indigenous peoples, like the role of ceremony and all that was really powerful. So say your prayers.
Yes. I know that some of these dams intersect with a lot of different tribes' land. And so I'm curious about what it looks like to try and coordinate between different tribes to have a somewhat singular objective, but have a bunch of different groups that probably have different ideas about process.
Yeah, it's being really respectful of each tribe's unique history and tribal law. And so it's making sure that you're working in coalitions and having common, frequent conversations with leadership and staff, and allowing and giving them the ability to say yes or no. It's like in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the whole sort of pillar of it is free, informed, prior consent. And I would say that's what we did on the Klamath.
Okay. What did it feel like to watch the dam come down?
The most magical healing moment of my entire life. The latter part of the book is really about those specific moments. And there were a few, right? Because there were four dams that came down, and there was a whole process of one, blowing holes in the dams in order to allow the water to drain. And because there was about 2,000 acres of reservoirs behind the dams, and watching that happen. But then I think one of the biggest ones was when Iron Gate Dam, the lowest dam on the river, was removed, and watching the river reconnect for the first time was so magical and powerful, and something I never thought I would get to see in my lifetime. And the only thing I can say is that it was like the most emotional, the most hopeful moment of my life. I'm a mother. I have three kiddos, and it's also like when your children are born, the feeling is just indescribable. But that's how it was to watch the river reconnect. And also, what was beautiful about it was that I felt like my ancestors were all there with me and were watching the river heal and are now resting in this deeper peace, knowing that our river is healing and our people have a future.
How has the reception to your book been so far within your community? I'm sure there's a lot of different people telling the story, if you will. How is reception to your particular vantage point of the story?
What's been the best part of all of this is that I've been out and about in the world on a bit of a book tour, and one, it started at home. We had a great event in the village of Recuay where people came, and my family members, who are all the characters in the book, got to be together, and we celebrated. And in that moment, we had people who worked on Klamath Dam removal who were there, and we all got to share our story. So what I love about this is it's creating a space for the thousands and thousands of champions of Klamath Dam removal to tell their own story, right? So not only just at home, but when we go out into the world, people who worked on Klamath Dam removal will come. And I always make sure that there's an opportunity for others to tell their story of Klamath Dam removal, because that's the way that we weave this web of community and hope and just inspiration, because there were so many people who were involved in this work, and every single one of them was so important. And this is about uplifting everyone and making everybody, feel good because they've done good work here.
Yeah.
So that's my
Well,
favorite part.
it sounds wonderful. This is a California history podcast, so I have a few history questions to kind of close up. California also has a lot of myths. A lot of those myths were created by industry to justify certain things. We have a lot of myths around the gold rush. We have a lot of myths around Silicon Valley. We have a lot of myths around Hollywood. Where I live in the Central Valley, we have a lot of myths around agriculture and its role. And I'm curious. We can dispel a lot of those myths because we now understand what they are. But I'm curious, how do you think this particular story of a journey of restoration, how that fits into the broader story of California? How would you think about that?
I think it's a whole new era. It's an era of decolonizing. So as soon as we removed those dams, 7 days later, the salmon came home. The river is now fiercer and than I've ever seen it in my whole life. The water is cooler, the water is cleaner. We have planted over 19 billion native seeds within 20,000 acres of land around the former project area. And throughout the basin as a whole, we are doing just restoration projects, water quality projects, land back projects. And it's remarkable to see how quickly nature heals and also how quickly the people of the Klamath Basin are transitioning from a culture of scarcity to back to a culture of abundance, right? Of enjoying the natural world and all its abundance, because it's starting to get stronger. The ecosystem is more resilient. And so what this does is show California that we have always been, well, we see ourselves now as a leader in environments, and we can be at a whole other level when we work together in coalitions. And I think we have to start addressing some of those myths and dispelling them and replacing them with this forward-thinking view of, okay, we're going to continue to be a pro-environmental state and work to uplift Indigenous peoples, other marginalized communities, and their rights, their views, and work to restore ecosystems so that we can continue to live in a healthy planet. It's all there. We're so powerful, right? We just have to set our intention towards inclusive restoration. And my final point I'll say is that Klamath Dam removal was profitable. We put $515 million into the economy. And so, what it shows is one, that nature-based solutions to the climate crisis work, but also we can have a global regenerative economy based on restoring ecosystems and create new industry where you have business coming in and restoring ecosystems rather than tearing them apart.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons that we've learned, and there was a great writer that passed away this past year, an anarchist anthropologist named James C. Scott. And he is incredible. And his last book, it was published posthumously, was about rivers. And it's a fascinating book. I would encourage you to read it. But prior to that, he had written a lot about how making changes to nature is so complicated because we don't really understand it, right? Because it's braided with so many different environments, flora, fauna, how the world works. So we need to be so careful before putting up a dam, if you will, before doing even small things to try our best to understand. And that's where history and time, where people that have lived, like you said, time immemorial in a place, have gathered this knowledge that's deep knowledge of land. And I think that is something that I hope California corrects, is making giant decisions about landscape for profit motives, for whatever, without understanding what they're changing, if you will.
Thank you for sharing that. And it's true that ecosystems are so complex and it's difficult for modern science to contemplate or anticipate how a project will impact nature. But what I will say is that highlights the need for indigenous knowledge because we have that knowledge that we've developed since time immemorial. And on the Klamath specifically, like our leaders, our elders, which our leaders consulted, they knew that if we remove those dams, nature would just heal itself. And so we had that confidence of we know how this ecosystem worked pre-colonization. And we know if you remove those dams, everything will go back to how it was. And not necessarily how it was, but everything will start healing. That's a better way of saying it. And that's exactly what we're seeing. No, and in any of the environmental studies, and there were many, nobody anticipated how quickly the salmon would come back, but the indigenous peoples knew. And so it just highlights how important traditional knowledge is in restoring ecosystems.
Yeah, that deep knowledge. So here's a broad question. It's not anything about specific to the Yurok people. For people like me that are on the outside of indigenous communities, we're trying our best to understand, at least I am. And while there's a few good books that come out periodically by folks, like one of the favorites that I always recommend people is called We Are the Land, which is a great indigenous history of California written by indigenous people that are also academics.
That's great.
And so that's an example. One of the authors is indigenous. But in any case, how, if you were just talking to the broad audience that's listening right now and they say, I want to understand more about indigenous history, what would you recommend as the most fruitful avenue for them to learn?
Oh, that is, I would definitely encourage them to read my book because it goes through all those issues, especially in California. And then there's many others. The one that comes to mind is Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, because that's a really important one that highlights different issues throughout the country and how Native people, the history of Native people. One of my favorite Indigenous authors, just like period, is Louise Edrich. And she tells these fascinating stories about, and they're, you know, they're some of, most of them are fiction, but they're so rooted in real Native type experience that I think they offer readers a really good perspective on how Indigenous families and values and worldviews play out through the generations.
Oh, yeah. The Roundhouse is a favorite of mine.
Don't you just love that one? Oh my
Yeah, I
God.
do.
Anything she writes, I just love.
Yes. We already jumped into book recommendations, but actually, hold on, before we move on, is there non-book related ways to learn about Indigenous people in history?
You can always go to the Yurok tribe's webpage, and there's a deep level of knowledge there about our history. Another one I love too is you could go to the Native American Rights Fund. NARF is what it's called. I worked there as an attorney back in the day. But if you go to their website, they have all kinds of great, what is a federally recognized Indian tribe? What is inherent sovereignty? How many tribes are in the United States? It's like just a very good place to learn more information about Native peoples. You could also go to the National Congress of American Indians website, and there you'll find a plethora of information about Indigenous peoples.
Okay, last question, Amy. What are you doing next? What's next on your agenda?
Oh man, I hope that I can continue to uplift the book and figure out different ways to tell the story. Maybe a children's book, maybe some film and TV. Also, we have a ton of work to do on in the basin. Dam removal was just the beginning, so we're working on some of those restoration projects I talked about. We are at Ridges to Riffles Indigenous Conservation Group. That's my nonprofit. We are working with a intertribal advisory committee that is leading the restoration, which is really cool because it puts that indigenous knowledge we were talking about in the sort of driver's seat of all that work. There's land back initiatives. We got to get water in the river. So that's what's next.
Okay.
Thank you.
Again, the book is The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. Amy, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.